Welcome to The Patriot, 1776. Hi, this is John Mady, and I am the pastor of Victory Baptist Church in North Fort Myers, Florida. And who is the Patriot of 1776? You are, and I am, and so is everyone who loves America and wants to follow the principles of our founding fathers. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence reads like this: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If it had not been for the Patriots of 1776, we would still be paying taxes to England and drinking a spot of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Help us win back America now, just like the Patriots of 1776 won America in the first place. You should take notes and use your Bible. We will give you our mailing address later. Today, we're going to continue with Margaret Sanger. And we're going to be looking at materials from blackgenocide.org. And so we'll begin this next portion. Quote, "During January and February of 1926, Sanger and her co-workers personally interviewed 40 senators and 14 representatives. None agreed to introduce a bill to amend the Comstock Act. Fresh for this unanimous rejection, Sanger issued an update to her followers. Everywhere there is general acceptance of the idea, except in religious circles, the National Catholic Welfare Council has a special legislative committee organized to block and defeat our legislation. They frankly state that they intend to legislate for non-Catholics according to the dictates of the Church. There was no such committee, but 20 non-Catholic lay or religious organizations joined NCWC in opposition to amending the Comstock Act. This was not the first time, nor was it to be the last time, that Sanger sought to stir up sectarian strife by blaming Catholics for her legislative failures. Catholic bashing was a standard tactic, one that Planned Parenthood still finds useful to this day, although other Christian groups now also come in for criticism. 8 years later, in 1934, Sanger went to Congress again, reporting on the first day of the hearings. The New York Times noted the almost solidly Catholic opposition to the measure. This is now, according to Margaret Sanger, the only organized opposition to the proposal. Sanger wrote a letter to her friends, co-workers, and endorsers that portrayed the opposing testimony as the work of Catholics determined not to present facts to the committee but to intimidate them by showing a Catholic bloc of voters who, though in the minority in the United States, want to dictate to the majority of non-Catholics as directed from the Vatican in social and moral legislation. American men and women, are we going to allow this insulting arrogance to bluff the American people?" For Sanger, the proper attitude toward her religious critics featured character assassination, personal vilification, and the old-fashioned bigotry. Her Birth Control Review printed an article that noted, "Today, by the Roman Catholic clergy and their allies, public opinion in America, I fear, is too willing to condone in the officials of the Roman Catholic Church what it condemns in the Ku Klux Klan." A favorite Catholic baiter of Sanger's was Norman Himes, who contributed articles to Sanger's journal. Himes claimed there were genetic differences between Catholics and non-Catholics. "Are Catholic stocks genetically inferior to such non-Catholic libertarian stocks and Unitarian and Universal Freethinkers? Inferior to non-Catholics in general? My guess is that the answer will someday be made in the affirmative. And if the supposed differences in net productivity are also genuine, the situation is antisocial, perhaps gravely so. Sanger sought to isolate Catholics by creating a schism between them and Protestants, who had held parallel views of birth control and abortion for centuries. She welcomed a report from the majority of the Committee on Marriage and the home of the General Council of Churches, later the National Council of Churches, advocating birth control. This committee was composed largely of social elite Protestants, including Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. A number of Protestant church bodies publicly repudiated the committee's endorsement. And let me stop a quote there. As you know, not all churches are real churches. And so when we talk about different churches and different cults, and there are some churches that people who know not the Lord Jesus Christ, they can go to those churches and feel very comfortable. And therefore, sometimes, depending on what's going on, sometimes people like Sanger will use these churches where people are not saved, and the cults, and use them for whatever direction they want to go. Godless people, it doesn't make any difference to them. If they lie, if they stretch the truth, it doesn't make any difference to them what they need to do to carry out what they want to accomplish. And so when we're reading here some of these people who might do things the same way that we as Christians would do things, doesn't necessarily mean that they're okay. It just means that that's the way that they're thinking on a particular point. All right, let's go on now. Quote, the Reverend Worth Tippy, Council Executive Secretary and author of the report, told Sanger in April 1931 that the statement on moral aspects of birth control has aroused more opposition within the Protestant churches than we expected. Under the circumstances, and since we plan to carry on a steady work for liberalizing laws and to stimulate the establishment of clinics, it is necessary that we make good these losses and also increase our resources. Could you help me quietly by giving me the names of people of means who are interested in the birth control movement and might help us if I wrote them? And here was Sanger's gamble. It was in 1939 that Sanger's larger vision for dealing with the reproductive practices of black Americans emerged. After the January 1939 merger of her Clinical Research Bureau and the ABCL to form the Birth Control Federation of America, Dr. Clarence Gamble was selected to become the regional director for the South. Dr. Gamble, of the soap manufacturing Procter and Gamble Company, was no newcomer to Sanger's organization. He had previously served as director at large to the predecessor. Gamble lost no time and drew up a memorandum in November 1939 entitled Suggestion for Negro Project. Acknowledging that black leaders might regard birth control as an extermination plot, he suggested that black leaders be placed in positions where it would appear that they were in charge. It was at the Atlanta conference. It is evident from the rest of the memo that Gamble conceived the project almost as a traveling roadshow. A charismatic black minister was to start a revival with contributions to come from other local cooperating ministers. A colored nurse would follow, supported by a subsidized colored doctor. Gamble even suggested that music might be a useful lure to bring the prospects to a meeting. Sanger answered Gamble on December the 10th, 1939. Agreeing with the assessment, she wrote, "We do not want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister is the man who can straighten that idea out if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members." In 1940, money for the two Negro Projects demonstration programs in southern states was donated by advertising magnate Albert Lasker and his wife, Mary. And so here you have people who are gathering together to try to get rid of black people. And Margaret Sanger is the one who is coordinating all of this. And so her program, as we now know it, and as it continues to be, Planned Parenthood. So now let's go on and read some more of this article. Birth control was presented both as an economic betterment vehicle and as a health measure that could lower the incidence of infant mortality. At the 1942 annual meeting, BCFA Negro Council board member Dr. Dorothy B. Farabee, a cum laude graduate of Tufts and also president of Alpha Kappa Alpha, the nation's largest black sorority, addressed the delegates regarding Planned Parenthood's minority outreach efforts. With the Negro group, some of them most difficult obstacles, and to overcome these obstacles, this is what they did. One, the concept that when birth control is proposed to them, it is motivated by a clever bit to persuade them to commit race suicide. The so-called husband rejection. The fact that birth control is confused with abortion and the belief that is inherently immoral. However, as formidable as these objections may seem, when overthrown against the total picture of the awareness on the part of the Negro leaders of the improved condition under Planned Parenthood, or the genuine interest and eagerness of the families themselves to secure the services which will give them a fair chance for health and happiness, the obstacles to the program are greatly outweighed. Birth control as an economic improvement measure had some appeal to those lowest on the income ladder. In the Black Chicago Defender for January the 10th, 1942, a long three-column women's interest article discussed the endorsement of the Sanger program by prominent black women. There were at least six express references, such as the following, to birth control as a remedy for economic woes. It raises the standard of living by enabling parents to adjust the family size to the family income. Readers were also told that birth control is no operation. It is no abortion. Abortion kills life after it is begun. Birth control is neither harmful nor immoral. But the moral stumbling block could only be surmounted by Afro-American religious leaders, so black ministers were solicited. Florence Rose, longtime Sanger secretary, prepared an activities report during March 1942 detailing the progress of the Negro Project. She recounted a certain meeting with a Planned Parenthood Negro Division board member, Bishop David Sims, African Methodist Episcopal Church, who appreciated Planned Parenthood's recognition of the extent of the black opposition to birth control and its efforts to build up support among black leaders. He offered whatever assistance he could give. Bishop Sims offered to begin the softening process among the representatives of different Negro denominations attending the monthly meetings of the Federal Council of Churches and its Division of Race Relations. These and other efforts paid off handsomely after World War II. By 1949, virtually the entire black leadership network of religious, social, professional, and academic organizations had endorsed Planned Parenthood's program. More than a decade later, Planned Parenthood continued targeting minority communities, but without much success. In 1940, non-white women aged 18 to 19 experienced 61 births per 1,000 unmarried women. In 1968, the corresponding figure was 112 per 1,000, 100% jump. What other factor could account for the increased rate of sexual activity than wider access to birth control, with its promise of sex without tears and consequences? Alan Guttmeier, then president of Planned Parenthood, was desperate to show policymakers that birth control would produce a situation whereby minority groups who constantly outbreed the majority will no longer persist in doing so. Despite claims that racial or ethnic groups were not being targeted, American blacks, among whose ranks a greater proportion of the poor were numbered, received a high priority in Planned Parenthood's nationwide efforts. Donald B. Strauss, chairman of Planned Parenthood World Population, urged the 1964 Democratic National Convention to liberalize the party's stated policies on birth control. While almost one-fourth of non-white parents have four or more children under 18 living with them, only 8% of white couples have that many children living at home. Unwanted children would not get the job, training, and educational skills they need to compete in a shrinking labor market. Moreover, unwanted children are a product and a cause of poverty. Surveying the successes of tax-subsidized birth control programs, Guttmeier noted in 1970 that birth control services are proliferating in areas adjacent to concentrations of black population. In the 1980s, targeting the inner-city black communities for school-based sex clinics became more sensitive than expected. Guttmacher thought that as long as the birth control rate continued to fall or remained at a low level, Planned Parenthood should certainly be introduced before the family size by coercion is attempted. Reaching this goal, he thought, would best be accomplished by having groups preach the doctrine of a normative 2.1 child family, as doing this would offend Planned Parenthood's minority clients. He suggested that family size would decrease if abortion were liberalized nationwide and received government support. In this prediction, he was right on target. But Guttmeier did not completely reject forced population control. Predicting 20 critical years ahead in the struggle to control the population explosion, Dr. Alan Guttmeier, president of Planned Parenthood World Population, continues to urge the use of all voluntary means to hold down the world birth rate. But he foresees the possibility that eventually coercion may be necessary, particularly in areas where the pressure is greatest, possibly India and China. Each country, he says, will have to decide its own form of coercion and determine when and how it should be employed. At present, the means are compulsory sterilization and compulsory abortion. Perhaps someday a way of enforcing compulsory birth control will be feasible. Coerced abortion is already practiced in China, with the International Planned Parenthood Federation's approval. Well, that's the way that it is. We've got this going, and you have to understand Planned Parenthood. You have to remember who's involved with these kinds of things. Who is it that, what's the purpose? Who is it that's wanting to see these things happen? What's the purpose? And I like what Rush Limbaugh always says about these things. Follow the money. Follow the money. I wonder what would happen if they were to say that the government would no longer pay for abortions. I wonder what would happen if the government always stopped paying for abortions. You have to remember this Roe versus Wade. That is not a law. There is no law that was passed. Only the legislature passes laws. And it's the Supreme Court who says whether or not that a law is constitutional. But the Supreme Court does not pass laws. So we have to go back to these things. And, you know, you need to go back and find out where these things come from. We have to go back to 1859 when Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species. You have to understand, The Origin of Species is a racist book. It's a book that was followed by Hitler. It's a book that was followed by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. It's a book that's followed by Margaret Sanger and her Planned Parenthood. It's a book that's followed by Richard Baldwin and his group, the ACLU, that he started in 1920. Margaret Sanger began her first abortion clinic in 1916, and it got shut down, and it was called a nuisance, and it was only open for 3 weeks, and she went to jail for a couple of months for that. And then in 1921, she started another one, and this one has kept going. And although it was under a different name, it's still the same Margaret Sanger's start from 1921. And the name of it today is called Planned Parenthood. And I don't know why they put parenthood in there, because there's nothing there that helps parents. So we've got, if you follow all these things, then you begin seeing all the things that are going on today, and you begin understanding them very easily. We have some presidents that were outstanding presidents in following those things. Woodrow Wilson was probably the first president to really tip the balance towards social Darwinism. And so you need to study Woodrow Wilson and see what happened during his presidency. And then FDR was another one that was for social Darwinism, and he started a lot of programs, as well as Woodrow Wilson. The two of them started a lot of programs that are communistic in nature. And we follow them today, and we think that they're just normal things. Probably one of the biggest things is Social Security. And people would say, well, don't take away my Social Security. I need that Social Security. That's true. But the thing that you have to look for is, what does it do? What it actually does is it keeps people from being able to have more money. You look at the county in Texas that pulled out of Social Security. And the people who started retiring, they found out that those people that were following that county in Texas, their retirement program, were getting 3 to 4 times more money than what they were getting in Social Security. You have to understand something about Social Security. With Social Security, when you die, all that money that's in there goes to the government. Whereas if you have a your own program, and then you die, then that money goes to your heirs. So there's a great big difference in those things. Now, just to tell a little bit about where we're headed, we've got just a few more characters that we want to follow. And it might be several more Sundays. I'm not sure how long it'll take. But when we finish with these, then we're going to start looking at the history around the year 1776. And also, a couple of other things that we want to do is to be able to look at some of the things that are going on today. We want to interview some people today that are working to make America great. And isn't that a strange phrase? But we've got groups that are right here in Florida that we're going to talk to. And we need to look at these groups, and we need to say, you know what, we do have a lot of people who are working to bring Christ back to America. And so we need to work together. We need to help one another. And this radio program is one that I hope that you will help us to get this program going, and that you will help us to be able to tell you all the different programs that are out here around Florida, all the different programs around here that are a help to us that we don't even know about. And they're working hard, and we don't even know about them. We need to find out about these programs. So we'll be talking to you again next Sunday. So comes the end of today's message. We appreciate so much that you spent time to be with us. If you enjoy our program, would you please take time to send us any questions you might have, along with a love offering of any amount? And if you send at least $25, we will send you a 92-page book, When Good Men Do Nothing, Who Will Speak? Our address is The Patriot, 1776, at 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Again, The Patriot, 1776. The address is 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Talk to you again next time. Goodbye now. Bye.